You have passed your time on earth, enduring the spectacle of high and mighty airs put on by reasons of state, oaths, political wisdom, human justice, professional probity, the strict requirements of position, incorruptible robes. It is a relief to step into a sewer and see the sludge that rightly belongs there. It teaches us something at the same time. As we said a moment ago, history passes through the sewer. The St. Bartholomew's filter into it drop by drop, seeping through the cobblestones. The great public assassinations, the political and religious butcheries, travel through this subterranean passage of civilization, pushing their cadavers along. To the eye of the dreamer, all the historic murderers are there, in the hideous gloom, on their knees, with a fold of their shrouds as apron, dourly mopping up their work. Louis XI is there with Tristan. François Premier is there with Duprat. Charles Neuf is there with his mother. Richelieu is there with Louis XIII. Louvois is there. Le Tellier is there. Hébert and Maillard are there, scraping stones and trying to make all traces of their actions disappear. You can hear the broom of these specters beneath these vaults. You breathe in the enormous fetidness of social catastrophes. You can see reddish gleams in the corners. A terrible water flows there in which bloody hands have been washed. The social observer should step into these shadows. They are part of his laboratory. Philosophy is the microscope of thought. Everything tries to run away from it, but nothing escapes it. To prevaricate is useless. What side of yourself do you show by prevaricating? The shame side. Philosophy pursues evil with its probing eye and will not let it escape into nothingness. In the erasure of things that disappear, in the diminishing of things that vanish, philosophy recognizes everything. It reconstructs the purple from the bit of rag and the woman from the tatters. With the cesspool, it reconstructs the city. With the muck, it reconstructs the morals and customs. From the shard, it completes the amphora, the pitcher. It recognizes by the imprint of a fingernail on a piece of parchment the difference that distinguishes the Jewry of the Judengasse from the Jewry of the ghetto. It retrieves from what remains what has been, the good, the bad, the false, the true, the bloodstain of the law court, the inkblot in the cave, the blob of tallow in the house of ill repute, the ordeals endured, the welcome temptations, the orgies spewed out, the kink that people have acquired in abasing themselves, the trace of prostitution in souls their own coarseness made them capable of, and, on the jacket of the porters of Rome, the mark of Messalina's dig in the ribs. Bruneseau. The Paris sewer was legendary in the Middle Ages. In the 16th century, Henri II tried some exploratory soundings, but they were aborted. Not even 100 years ago, as Mercier can attest, the cesspit was left to its own devices and went its own way. That was the old Paris for you, given up to carping, dithering, and groping around in the dark. It was not terribly bright for quite some time. Later, 1789 showed how towns can get some sense into them, but in the good old days, the capital did not have much of a head. It did not know how to do business, either morally or materially, and had no more idea how to get rid of its rubbish than its abuses. Everything was too hard, everything was called into question. The sewer, for instance, rebelled against any itinerary. People could not get their bearings in the waste-dump network any more than they could make themselves understood in the city. Up above, the unintelligible babble, down below, an inextricable tangle. Beneath the confusion of tongues lay the confusion of cellars. Daedalus replicated Babel. Sometimes the sewer of Paris took it upon itself to overflow, as though this undervalued Nile was suddenly rocked by anger. It is pretty revolting, but sometimes the sewer flooded. This stomach of civilization occasionally had trouble digesting. The cesspit gurgled back up into the city's gullet, and Paris had an aftertaste of its gutter. These instances of resemblance between the sewer and remorse had a good side. They were warnings, very badly received warnings, though, with the city fuming over its sludge, having such gall and not accepting that what you dump can come back to haunt you. Get rid of it better. The flood of 1802 is still a living memory for Parisians of 80. The muck spread out in a cross at the Place de Victoire, where the statue of Louis XIV stands. It entered the Rue Saint-Honoré through the two sewer mouths in the Champs-Élysées, the Rue Saint-Florentin through the Saint-Florentin sewer, the Rue Pierre-à-Poisson through the sewer of the Sonnerie, the Rue Popincourt through the sewer of the Chemin Vert, and the Rue de la Roquette through the sewer of the Rue de l'Ape. It filled the gutters of the Rue de Champs-Élysées to a depth of 35 centimeters, and at midday, through the vomitorium of the Seine performing its function in reverse, it penetrated the Rue Mazarine, the Rue de l'Échaudet, and the Rue des Marais, where it stopped after going 109 meters, just a few feet short of the house Racine once lived in, respecting, of the 17th century, the poet more than the king. It attained its maximum depth in the Rue Saint-Pierre, where it rose to a level of 3 feet above the flagstones of the waterspout, and its maximum reach in the Rue Saint-Sabin, where it spread out for 238 meters. At the beginning of this century, the Paris sewer was still a mysterious place. Sludge can never smell sweet, but here its reputation was so bad as to strike fear. Paris was vaguely aware that it had a terrible cellar under it. People talked about it as though it were the monstrous bog of Thebes, which teemed with scolopendra, gargantuan sea monsters 15 feet long, and which could easily have served as a bathtub for behemoth. The great boots of the sewer workers never ventured beyond certain known points. This was still not long after the days when the garbage collector's carts, on which Sainte-Foy fraternized with the Marquis de Créqui, were simply emptied straight into the sewer. As for any cleaning operation, this was left to stormwater, which gummed up the works more than flushed them out. Rome let a little poetry stick still to its cloaca and called it the Gemonii. Paris insulted its and called it the stinkhole. Science and superstition were in agreement as to its horror. The stinkhole was no less averse to hygiene than to legend. The goblin monk had hatched under the fetid arch of the Mouffetard sewer. The cadavers of the Marmousets had been thrown into the sewer of the Barillerie. Fagon had attributed the fearful malignant fever of 1685 to the big open hole in the Marais sewer, which remained gaping until 1833 in the Rue Saint-Louis, practically in front of the inn sign for the Messager Galant. The manhole in the Rue de la Mortellerie was famous for the plagues that came out of it, with its grate of pointy iron bars, simulating a row of teeth. It was as deadly in that street as a dragon's maw blowing hell over mankind. The popular imagination seasoned the somber Parisian sink with an unspeakably hideous dose of the boundless. The sewer was a bottomless pit. The sewer was the barathrum, the gorge outside Athens, into which criminals were cast. The idea of exploring these pestilential regions did not occur even to the police. To tempt that unknown, to throw a plumb line into that shadowland, to go on a voyage of discovery into that abyss, who would have dared? It was terrifying. Someone did turn up, though. The cesspit had its Christopher Columbus. On a day in 1805, on one of the rare appearances the emperor put in Paris, the minister of the interior, a Decret or Créter or someone, came to the master's morning levee. You could hear the clatter of the swords in the carousel of all those amazing soldiers of the mighty Republic and the mighty Empire. There was a glut of heroes tripping over themselves at Napoleon's door, men from the Rhine, from the Scheldt, the Adige, and the Nile, companions of Joubert, Desaix, Marceau, Hoche, Kléber, balloonists from Fleurus, grenadiers from Mayence, pontoniers from Genoa, hussars that the pyramids had gazed upon, artillerymen Junot's cannonballs had spattered, cuirassiers who had stormed the battle fleet at anchor in the Zuider Zee. Some had followed Bonaparte over the bridge at Lodi. Others had been with Murat in the trenches of Mantua. Still others had gone before long in the sunken road of Montebello. The whole army of those days was there, in the courtyard of the Tuileries, represented by a squad or a platoon, and was guarding Napoleon while he rested. It was the splendid time when the Grande Armée had Marengo behind it and Austerlitz ahead of it. "Sire," said the Minister of the Interior to Napoleon, "yesterday I saw the boldest man in your empire." "Who is this man?" the Emperor promptly asked. "And what has he done?" "It's what he wants to do, sire."
"Which is what?"
"To visit the sewers of Paris." This man existed, and his name was Brinezeau. Details nobody knows. The visit took place. It was a formidable campaign, a nocturnal battle against plague and asphyxiation. It was, at the same time, a voyage of discovery. One of the survivors of the expedition, a smart sewer worker, very young at the time, was still a few years ago telling anyone who'd listen the curious details that Brunezeau thought it best to leave out of his report to the prefect of police as unworthy of the administrative style. Disinfecting procedures were very rudimentary in those days. Brunezeau had only just got past the first sections of the underground network when 8 out of the 20 workers with him refused to go any farther. The operation was complicated. The visit involved cleaning, so clean they must, but at the same time they had to survey, to note the water inlets, to count the grates and the grids, to detail the connecting pipes, to jot down the currents at drainage divides, to identify the respective capacities of the various basins, to probe the small sewers grafted onto the main sewer, to measure the height under the keystone of each tunnel, along with the width both at the spring of the vault and level with the floor, and last, to determine the different levels at the right of each water inlet, both from the sewer floor and from the street surface. They made painful headway. It was not uncommon for the stepladders to sink into 3 feet of mud. The lanterns kept flickering and going out in the noxious vapors. From time to time they would have to carry out a sewer worker who had fainted. At certain places there would be a sheer drop. The ground would have given way, the flagstones would have crumbled, the sewer would have turned into a sinkhole. There was nothing solid left. One man promptly disappeared, and they had great difficulty pulling him out. On Fourcroy's advice, they lit at intervals, in spots sufficiently cleaned, great cages full of tow, soaked in resin. In some places, the wall was covered with gnarled funguses that looked for all the world like tumors. The stone itself seemed sick in that unbreathable environment. Brunezeau proceeded downstream on his exploratory expedition. At the parting of the two water mains from the Grand Hurleur, he deciphered the date 1550 on a jutting stone, indicating the point reached by Philibert de Lorme, who was given the job by Henri II of visiting the underground waste dumps of Paris. This stone was the 16th century's mark on the sewer. Brunezeau also found the 17th century's handiwork in the Ponceau conduit and in the conduit from the Rue Vieille du Temple, both vaulted between 1600 and 1650, as well as the 18th century's handiwork in the west section of the collector canal, laid down and vaulted in 1740. These two vaults, especially the more recent one, the one from 1740, were more cracked and decrepit than the masonry of the ring sewer, which dated from 1412, a time when the bubbling brook of Menilmontant was elevated to the rank of main sewer of Paris, a promotion analogous to a peasant's becoming premier valet de chambre to the king, something like Grosjean transformed into Le Bel. Here and there, notably under the Palais de Justice, they thought they recognized the cavities of old dungeons cut into the sewer itself. Ghastly in pace. An iron collar hung in one of these cells. They walled them all up. Some finds were bizarre, among others the skeleton of an orangutan that had disappeared from the Jardin des Plantes in 1800, a vanishing act probably connected to the famous and incontestable appearance of the devil in the Rue de Bernardin in the last year of the 18th century. The poor devil had ended up drowning in the sewer. Under the long vaulted corridor that ends in the Arche Marion, a rag-and-bone man's sack, perfectly preserved, was the admiration of connoisseurs. Everywhere the mud, which the sewer workers had come to handle fearlessly, abounded in precious objects, gold and silver jewelry, precious stones, coins. If a giant had sifted through this cloaca, he would have collected the riches of centuries in his sieve. At the parting of the two branches of the Rue du Temple and the Rue Saint-Avoie, they picked up a singular Huguenot medallion in copper, bearing on one side a pig capped with a cardinal's hat, and on the other a wolf wearing a tiara on its head. The most surprising encounter was at the entrance to what was called the Grand Sewer. This inlet had previously been closed by a grate, of which only the hinges remained. From one of these hinges hung a sort of grimy, shapeless rag, a remnant of something no doubt caught there as it was going by, floating in the dark, that had wound up being torn to shreds. Bruneseau held up his lantern and examined this shred. It was of very fine cambric, and they made out at one of the least worn corners a heraldic crown embroidered above these seven letters, LAVBESP. The crown was a marquis's coronet, and the seven letters stood for L'Aubespine. They realized that what they were looking at was a piece of Marat's shroud. Marat, in his youth, had had his share of love affairs. This was when he was part of the household of the Comte d'Artois in his capacity as a physician to the stables. From his love affair with the great lady, which is a matter of historical record, he had kept this bedsheet. At his death, as it was the only remotely fine linen he had at his place, they had buried him in it. Old women had bundled up the tragic friend of the people for the grave in these swaddling clothes that had known the pleasures of the flesh. Bruneseau moved on. They left the flap of cloth where it was, without finishing it off. Out of scorn or respect, Marat deserved both. And then again, destiny was imprinted clearly enough on it for anyone to hesitate to touch it. Besides, what is entombed should be left where it chooses to be. In a word, the relic was strange. A marquise had slept in it. Marat had rotted in it. It had passed through the Panthéon, only to wind up down with the sewer rats. This intimate boudoir rag, whose every crease Watteau would once have drawn with delight, had wound up worthy of Dante's penetrating glare. The complete visit of the foul underground waste dump of Paris took 7 years, from 1805 to 1812. As he wended his way, Bruneseau designed, directed, and brought to completion substantial public works. In 1808, he lowered the canal floor of the Ponceau drain and, creating new lines everywhere, drove the sewer under the Rue Saint-Denis as far as the Fontaine des Innocents in 1809, under the Rue Froidmanteau and La Salpêtrière in 1810, under the Rue Neuve des Petits Pères, the Rue du Mail, the Rue de l'Écharpe, and the Place Royale in 1811, and under the Rue de la Paix and the Chaussée d'Antin in 1812. At the same time, he had the entire network disinfected and cleaned. From the second year on, Bruneseau took on his son-in-law, Nargaud, as his assistant. That is how, at the beginning of this century, the old society cleaned up its double backside and performed its sewer's toilette. That was one act cleaned up, at least. Tortuous, fissured, unpaved, cracked, sliced up by quagmires, jolted by sharp bends, rising and falling without rhyme or reason, fetid, feral, savage, submerged in darkness, with scars on its flagstones and gashes on its walls, appalling. Such was, in retrospect, the antique sewer of Paris. Ramifications in all directions, crisscrossing trenches, connecting drain pipes, junctions like crow's feet, stars as in saps, sica, cul-de-sacs, vaults covered with saltpeter, putrid sinkholes, scurfy scabs oozing over the walls, drips dripping from the ceiling, darkness. Nothing equaled the horror of this old crypt. The digestive apparatus of Babylon. Lair, pit, chasm bored through by streets, titanic molehill where the mind seems to see prowling through the shadows in filth that once was splendor, that enormous blind mole, the past. This, we repeat, was the sewer of days gone by. Current progress. Today the sewer is clean, cold, upright, correct. It practically achieves the ideal of what is understood in England by the word respectable. It is decent and dull, straight as a die, we might almost say immaculate. It is like a supplier who has become a councillor of state. You can almost see clearly in it. The muck behaves itself there. At first glance you could mistake it for one of those underground tunnels once so common and so handy for the flight of monarchs and princes in the good old days, when the people loved their kings. The current sewer is a beautiful sewer. The pure style reigns there. The classic rectilinear Alexandrine, driven out of poetry, seems to have taken refuge in architecture, apparently fusing with each and every stone in this long, gloomy, whitish vault. Every overflow pipeline is an arcade. Rue de Rivoli has its imitators even in the cloaca. In any case, if the geometric line has a place anywhere, it is surely in the stercorary trenches of a great city. There, everything must be subordinate to the shortest path. The sewer has today taken on a certain official aspect. Even the police reports of which it is sometimes the object now show respect for it. The terms used to describe it in administrative language are elevated and dignified. What was once known as a gut is now a gallery. What was once known as a hole is now a light shaft. Villon would no longer recognize his antiquated bolt hole. This network of cellars, of course, still has its time-honored population of rodents, more teeming than ever. From time to time, a rat, old Whiskers, risks popping his head out of the sewer window to examine the Parisians. But these very vermin are becoming tame, satisfied as they are with their subterranean palace. The cloaca has nothing left now of its primitive ferocity. The rain which befouled the sewer of bygone days washes today's sewer clean. But don't rely on it too much. Miasmas still inhabit it. It is more hypocritical than irreproachable. The Prefecture of Police and the Health Department have toiled in vain. Despite all the cleansing processes, it gives off a faintly suspect odor, like Tartuffe after confession. Let's agree, though, since cleaning is, all things considered, a tribute that the sewer pays to civilization, and since, from this point of view, Tartuffe's conscience is an advance and Ogeus is stable, the sewer of Paris has most certainly improved. It is more than an advance, it is a transmutation. Between the old sewer and the current sewer, there has been a revolution. Who brought about this revolution? The man everyone forgets, but whom we have named Brinezeau. Future progress. The excavation of the Paris sewer was no mean feat. They worked on it for the last 10 centuries, without being able to finish the job any more than they were able to finish Paris. The sewer, in fact, reaps all the after-effects of the growth of Paris. It is a sort of dark polyp with 1,000 antennae sitting in the earth and growing down below at the same time as the city above. Every time the city carves out a street, the sewer stretches out an arm. The old monarchy only built 23,300 meters of sewers. That's as far as Paris had got by January 1, 1806. From that period, which we will talk about again shortly, the work was usefully and energetically resumed and continued. Napoleon built, the figures are curious, 4,804 meters, Louis XVIII, 5,709, Charles X, 10,836, Louis-Philippe, 89,020, the Republic of 1848, 23,381. The current regime, 70,500. In all, at the present time, 226,610 meters, or 60 leagues of sewers, form Paris's enormous entrails. Obscure ramification, always in labor. An immense construction project that goes unnoticed. As you can see, the underground maze of Paris is today 10 times what it was at the beginning of the century. It is hard to imagine all the perseverance and effort required to bring this cloaca to the point of relative perfection it has now attained. It was with great difficulty at the old monarchical provostship, and in the last 10 years of the 18th century, the revolutionary mayoralty managed to tunnel out the 5 leagues of sewers that existed before 1806. All kinds of obstacles got in the way of this operation, some to do with the nature of the soil, others inherent in the very prejudices of the working population of Paris. Paris is built on a deposit strangely resistant to the pick, to mud, to the plumb bob, to manhandling. There is nothing harder to drill through and penetrate than the geological formation that the marvelous historical formation known as Paris sits on top of. As soon as work in any shape or form begins and ventures into that nap of alluvial sediment, subterranean resistance abounds in the form of liquid clays, springs, hard rock, the soft, deep silt that the special science calls mustard. The pick makes slow headway in those calcareous plates, alternating with very thin veins of potter's clay and layers of schist containing sheets encrusted with oyster shells, contemporary with the pre-Adamite oceans. Sometimes a stream abruptly causes a vault under construction to cave in and floods the workers, or a marl slide occurs, moving with the fury of a waterfall and shattering the great wooden support beams like glass. Only very recently, at Villette, when they needed to take the main sewer under the Canal Saint-Martin without interrupting navigation and without emptying the canal, a fissure opened in the canal basin. Water suddenly rose in the subterranean work site at a rate faster than the pumps could pump it out. They had to get a diver to look for the fissure, which turned out to be in the neck of the main basin, and they had a hell of a job blocking it up. Elsewhere, close to the Seine, and even some distance from the river, at Belleville, Grande Rue, and the Lunière Arcade, for instance, you come across quicksand, where a man can drop out of sight in a trice. Add suffocation from miasmas, entombment from landslides, the earth suddenly caving in. Add typhus slowly permeating the workers. In our day, after having dug out the Clichy gallery and provided it with a track for holding a water main to take water from the Ourcq, works executed in a cutting 10 meters deep, after having survived all the landslides and often putrid excavations to vault over the Bièvre River from the Boulevard de l'Hôpital as far as the Seine, after having endeavored to rescue Paris from the torrential waters of Montmartre and to provide a runoff for the fluvial pond 9 hectares across, which used to stagnate near the Barrière des Martyrs, after having built the sewer line from the Barrière Blanche to the Aubervilliers Road in 4 months flat, working day and night at a depth of 11 meters, after having built an underground sewer in the Rue Barre du Bec without a cutting 6 meters below ground, something never before seen, the foreman, Monod, dropped dead. After having vaulted 3,000 meters of sewers over every bit of the city, from the Rue Travassière-Saint-Antoine to the Rue de l'Ourcine, after having drained off through the Arbalète drain the stormwater that used to flood the Sancier-Mouffetard junction, after having built the Saint-Georges sewer on dry stone revetment and concrete in shifting sands, after having directed the awe-inspiring lowering of the floor of the Notre-Dame de Nazareth drain, the engineer, Dulot, dropped dead. There are no bulletins for these particular acts of bravery, even though they are rather more useful than the mindless bloodbaths of the battlefield. The sewers of Paris in 1832 were far from being what they are today. Bruneseau had set things in motion, but it needed cholera to spur the vast reconstruction that has taken place since. It may come as a shock to know, for example, that in 1821, part of the ring sewer known as the Grand Canal, as in Venice, was still stagnating out in the open, in the Rue de Gourde. It was not until 1823 that the city of Paris found in its purse the 266,080 francs and 6 centimes needed to cover over this vile abscess. The 3 absorbing dead wells of the Combat, the Cunette, and Saint-Mandé, with their overflow pipes, their machinery, their sumps, and their purifying connecting drains, date only from 1836. The intestinal waste dump of Paris has been completely revamped, becoming, as we said, 10 times what it was a quarter of a century ago. 30 years ago, at the time of the insurrection of June 5th and 6th, It was still in many places practically the old sewer. A very large number of streets, today cambered, were then very uneven tracks. You very often saw, at the dip where the sides of a street or an intersection ended, wide, square grates with big bars whose iron shone, burnished by the feet of the crowd. These were dangerous and slippery for carriages, and caused horses to take a tumble. The official language of the Department of Civil Engineering gave these dips and grates the expressive term cassis, black currants. In 1832, in a whole host of streets, Rue de l'Étoile, Saint-Louis, Du Temple, Vieille Du Temple, Notre-Dame de Nazareth, Folie-Méricourt, Quai aux Fleurs, Rue de Petit Musc, de Normandie, Pont aux Biches, des Marais, Faubourg Saint-Martin, Rue Notre-Dame des Victoires, Faubourg Montmartre, Rue Grange-Batelière, in the Champs-Élysées, Rue Jacob, Rue de Tournon, the old Gothic cloaca still cynically flashed its gaping chops. These were enormous gaps in stone building blocks, occasionally surrounded by curbstones, in a show of monumental effrontery. Paris in 1806 was practically still at the same sewer figures as that recorded in May 1663, 10,384 meters. After Brunezeau, on January 1, 1832, it had 40,300 meters. From 1806 to 1831, they had built 750 meters on average a year. Since then, they have built 8 and even 10,000 meters of galleries of masonry every year, using small materials with a bath of hydraulic cement poured over a concrete base. At 200 francs a meter, the 60 leagues of sewers of today's Paris represent 48 million francs. Apart from the economic progress that we indicated at the beginning, serious public hygiene issues are linked to this immense problem, the Paris sewer. Paris lies between two sheets, a sheet of water and a sheet of air. The sheet of water, which lies fairly deep underground, but is already being explored by two bores, is provided by a layer of green sandstone lying between chalk and Jurassic limestone. This layer may be represented by a disc with a radius of 25 leagues. A whole host of rivers and streams trickle into it. When you drink a glass of the water from the Grenelle well, you are drinking the Seine, the Marne, the Yonne, the Oise, the Aisne, the Cher, the Vienne, and the Loire. The sheet of water is healthy. It comes from the sky, first of all, then from the ground. The sheet of air is unhealthy. It comes from the sewer. All the miasmas of the cloaca blend into the air the city breathes. Hence its bad breath. Air taken from above a pile of manure, this has been scientifically observed, is purer than air taken from above Paris. Eventually, with the help of progress, mechanisms currently being developed, together with our growing enlightenment, will allow us to use the sheet of water to purify the sheet of air, meaning we will wash the sewer. By washing the sewer, of course, we mean restoring the muck to the earth, sending the dung back to the soil to fertilize the fields. This simple act will mean a decrease in misery and an increase in health for the whole social community. At the present time, diseases from Paris spread out over a radius of 50 leagues around the Louvre, taken as the hub of this pestilential wheel. You could say that for 10 centuries, the cloaca has been the disease of Paris. The sewer is the vice the city has in its blood. The people's instinct has never been wrong. The job of sewer worker was once almost as perilous and almost as repulsive for the people as the job of slaughterer in an abattoir. A job tainted with horror and long abandoned to the executioner. It needed high pay to persuade a mason to disappear into that fetid sap. The well-sinker's ladder thought twice before it plunged in. A proverb had it that to go down into the sewer is to step into the grave. And all sorts of hair-raising legends, as we said, once covered with horror that colossal sink. Dreaded, putrescent swamp that bears the trace of the revolutions of the terrestrial globe, just as it does the revolutions of men, and in which vestiges of all the cataclysms are to be found, from shells dating back to the flood, right down to Marat's flap of rag. Book 3. It may be muck, but it is still the soul. The Cloaca and its surprises. It was in the Paris sewer that Jean Valjean found himself. A further resemblance between Paris and the sea, as in the ocean, the diver can disappear there. The transition was startling, smack bang in the middle of the city. Jean Valjean had left the city behind, and in the twinkling of an eye, the time it took to lift up a lid and put it back down again, he had gone from broad daylight to utter darkness, from midday to midnight, from hubbub to silence, from the whirlwind of thunder and lightning to the stagnation of the tomb. And through even more amazing twists and turns than those of the Rue Polonceau, from the most extreme peril to the most absolute safety. It meant tumbling abruptly into a vault, disappearing into the oubliette of Paris, quitting the streets where death lurked everywhere, for a sort of sepulchre where there was life. A strange moment. He remained apparently dazed for a few seconds, listening, stunned. The trapdoor of salvation had suddenly opened under him. A heavenly goodness had, in a way, taken him by stealth in one of those fabulous ambushes of providence. Only the wounded man did not stir, and Jean Valjean had no idea whether the man he was carrying into this pit was alive or dead. His first sensation was of blindness. Suddenly he could not see a thing. It also felt as though he'd gone deaf in 1 minute flat. He could not hear a thing. The frenetic storm of murder that was raging a few feet above him did not reach him, as we said, thanks to the thick chunk of earth that separated him from it, except in a muted, indistinct way, like rumbling at a great depth. He felt that the ground was solid beneath his feet. That was all, but it was enough. He stretched out one arm, then the other, touching the wall on either side, and realized the corridor was narrow. He slipped and realized the flagstones were wet. He advanced a foot cautiously, fearing a hole, a well, some kind of gulf. He found that the flagging continued. A terrible stink alerted him to where he was. After a few moments he was no longer blind. A trickle of light fell from the air vent through which he had slipped, and his eyes adjusted to the vault. He began to make something out. The tunnel where he was holed up, no other words could express the situation better, was walled in behind him. It was one of those dead ends that the technical language terms a branch pipe. In front of him stood another wall, a wall of darkness. The light from the air vent died out 10 or 12 feet in front of Jean Valjean and barely cast a wan whiteness over a few meters of the damp sewer wall. Beyond that, the opacity was massive. To penetrate further into it seemed horrible. To step into it felt like being swallowed up. But you could sink into this wall of mist, and it had to be done. It had to be done very quickly, even. Jean Valjean thought that the grate he had spotted under the paving stones could also be spotted by the soldiers, and that there was every chance it would be. They could hop down into the well, too, and search it. There was not a minute to lose. He had deposited Marius on the ground, and now he gathered him up again, this being the right phrase, and threw him over his shoulders once more, and set out, stepping resolutely into the darkness. The reality was that they were not as safe as Jean Valjean had thought. Perils of another kind, no less great, were perhaps awaiting them. After the blazing whirlwind of combat came the cavern of miasmas and traps. After chaos, the cesspit. Jean Valjean had fallen from one circle of hell into another. When he had gone 50 paces, he had to stop. A question presented itself. The corridor ended in another narrow tunnel which it met side on. Which way should he go? Left or right? How could a man get his bearings in this black labyrinth? The labyrinth, as we noted earlier, has a thread which is its downward slope. Following the downward slope means reaching the river. Jean Valjean caught on instantly. He told himself that he was probably in the sewer at Les Halles, that if he chose the left fork and followed the slope, he would, in about 15 minutes, reach some outlet opening onto the Seine, between the Pont au Change and the Pont Neuf, meaning he would pop up in broad daylight at the most crowded spot in Paris. Maybe he would come out in some sunny stretch of a public square. Imagine the stupor of the bystanders seeing two men covered in blood emerging from out of the ground beneath their feet. The cops would arrive, there'd be a call to arms at the nearest guardhouse. They'd be nabbed before they fully surfaced. Better to sink into the maze, trust to that blackness, and rely on Providence for an exit. He went back up the slope and took the right. When he had turned the corner of the gallery, the distant gleam from the air vent disappeared. The curtain of darkness fell back over him, and he went blind again. But he forged ahead, regardless, and as fast as his legs would carry him. Malius's arms were hanging around his neck, and his feet dangling behind him. He had hold of both arms with one hand, and groped along the wall with the other. Malius's cheek touched his own and stuck to it like glue, being covered in blood. He felt a warm stream that came from Malius flow over him and seep into his clothes. Yet a damp warmth in the ear pressed against the wounded man's mouth indicated there was still breath and consequently life. The corridor through which Jean Valjean was now wending his way was not as narrow as the first. Jean Valjean walked along it, though pretty painfully. The rains of the night before had not yet run off, and they formed a small torrent in the middle of the channel floor, and he was forced to hug the wall to keep his feet out of the water. And so, on he staggered in the dark. He was like one of those nocturnal creatures groping through the invisible, lost underground in the veins of shadow. And yet, little by little, either because distant air vents were sending a bit of flickering light into this opaque mist, or because his eyes were getting used to the dark, some feeble sight returned, and he began to be vaguely aware again, here of the wall he was touching, there of the vault he was passing under. The pupil dilates in the night, and ends up finding a kind of daylight there, just as the soul dilates in misery, and ends up finding God. Finding his way was hard. The layout of the sewers reflects, so to speak, the layout of the streets lying on top. In the Paris of the day, there were 2,200 streets. Try to imagine this forest of dark branches known as the sewer underneath that. Placed end to end, the sewer system existing at the time would have measured 11 leagues in length. As we said earlier, the current network is no less than 60 leagues long. Jean Valjean had gone wrong from the start. He thought he was under the Rue Saint-Denis, and it is a shame he wasn't. Under the Rue Saint-Denis, there is an old stone sewer dating from Louis XIII's day that runs straight into the main sewer, known as the Grand Égout, the Grand Sewer, with only a single sharp turn on the right-hand side under the old Cour des Miracles and a single connecting drain, the Saint-Martin Sewer, whose four intersecting arms form a cross. But the Petite Truanderie Gallery, whose inlet was near the Corinthe Tavern, has never been connected to the underground passage under the Rue Saint-Denis. It ends in the Montmartre sewer, and that was where Jean Valjean was tangled up. There, opportunities to get lost abounded. The Montmartre sewer is one of the most labyrinthine in the old network. Luckily, Jean Valjean had left behind him the sewer of Les Halles, whose geometric layout shows like a whole bevy of interlocking topgallant masts. But he had ahead of him more than one tricky encounter and more than one street corner, for these are streets popping up in the dark like a question mark. First, on his left, the vast Platrière sewer, a sort of Chinese puzzle, shoving and scrambling its chaotic jumble of T-intersections and Z-bends under the Hôtel des Postes, and under the rotunda at the wheat market, and as far as the Seine, where it ends in a Y. Second, on his right, the curved tunnel of the Rue du Cadran, with its three teeth which are so many dead ends. Third, on his left, the My Branch line, complicated very near the entrance by a sort of fork, and zigzagging along to end in the great outfall basin of the Louvre, where it breaks up into sections and branches out in all directions. Last, on his right, the dead-end tunnel of the Rue des Genoux. This was without counting the tiny offshoots here and there before you get to the ring sewer, which alone could lead him to some exit far enough away to be safe. If Jean Valjean had had any idea of the above, He would quickly have realized, just by feeling the wall, that he was not in the underground gallery of the Rue Saint-Denis. Instead of the old hewn stone, instead of the ancient architecture, which was noble and regal even in the sewer, with channel floor and water courses of granite and rich lime mortar, the latter costing over 400 livres per meter, he would have felt beneath his hand the then contemporary crumminess, the economic expedient, the millstone rock of a hydraulic mortar bed over a layer of concrete that costs a mere 200 francs a meter, bourgeois masonry known as small materials. But he knew nothing about any of that. He forged ahead, anxious but calm, seeing nothing, knowing nothing, absorbed in random chance, that is, engulfed by providence. By degrees, we have to say, horror crept over him. The shadows that enveloped him entered his mind. He was walking through a puzzle. The cloaca aqueduct is glumly forbidding. It weaves around, dizzyingly intertwining. It is pretty grim being caught up in this Paris of darkness. Jean Valjean was obliged to find, almost to invent, his route without seeing it. Within this unknown, every step he risked could be his last. How would he ever get out of there? Would he find a way out? Would he find it in time? Would this colossal subterranean sponge, with alveoli of stone, let itself be penetrated and pierced through? Would he stumble across some unexpected knot of obscurity in there? Would they come to a part where they would get stuck and stay there, stranded? Would Marius die there of a hemorrhage and himself of starvation? Would they wind up getting lost in there, the two of them, and end up as two skeletons in some pocket of that black night? He did not know. He asked himself all this, but could not give himself any answers. The bowels of Paris are bottomless. He was, like the prophet, in the belly of the monster whale. Suddenly, he had a jolt. At the most unpredictable moment, and without his having stopped walking in a straight line, he noticed he was no longer going uphill. The water of the stream churned at his heels instead of coming at his toes. The sewer was now running downward. How come? Was he about to suddenly hit the Seine? The danger of that was great, but the peril of going back was even greater. He forged ahead. It was not toward the Seine that he was heading. The hump formed by the soil of Paris on the right bank empties one of its sides into the Seine and the other into the Grand Sewer. The ridge of the hump that determines which way the water flows follows an extremely capricious line. The culmination point, which is the point at which the runoff divide occurs, is above the Rue Michel le Comte, in the Saint-Avoie sewer, close to the boulevards, in the Louvre sewer, and close to Les Halles in the Montmartre sewer. It was this culmination point that Jean Valjean had reached. He was heading for the Ring sewer. He was on the right track, but he didn't know it. Whenever he came to a side drain, he groped around the opening, and if he found it was not as wide as the tunnel he was in, he did not go into it, but continued on his way, judging, rightly, that a narrower passage would end in a dead end, and could only take him away from the goal, that is, the way out. And so he avoided the fourfold trap laid out for him in the darkness by the four mazes mentioned above. At a certain moment he realized that he had moved away from under the Paris, petrified by the riot, where the barricades had brought traffic to a standstill, and back under the normal Paris, alive and bustling. He suddenly heard a noise like thunder overhead, distant but continuous. It was the rumbling of carriages. He had been walking for about half an hour, at least according to his inner reckoning, and had not yet thought about resting. The only thing he'd done was change the hand supporting Marius. The darkness was deeper than ever, but this deep darkness reassured him. All of a sudden, he saw his shadow in front of him. It stood out against a feeble, almost indistinct red patch that vaguely turned the channel floor at his feet and the vault over his head crimson as it slid to left and right over the two slimy walls of the tunnel. Stunned, he wheeled round. Behind him, in the section of tunnel he had just traversed, at a distance that seemed to him immense, a sort of horrible star was flaring, lighting up the dense darkness, and it looked to be watching him. It was the dark star of the police rising in the sewer. behind this star, moving around confusedly, were 8 or 10 black shapes, erect, indistinct, terrifying. Explanation. During the day of June 6th, a battue of the sewers had been ordered. It was feared that they might be used as a refuge by the vanquished, and the prefect, Gisquet, was supposed to scour the hidden Paris, while General Bugeaud swept the public Paris. A twin operation that demanded a twin strategy from the public force, represented by the army up above and the police down below. 3 platoons of officers and sewer workers explored the subterranean streets of Paris, the first the right bank, the second the left bank, the third the Ile de la Cité. The officers were armed with carbines, clubs, swords, and daggers. What was at that moment directed at Jean Valjean was the lantern of the right bank patrol. This patrol had just been through the curved gallery and the 3 dead ends lying under the Rue du Caudron. While they were waving their lantern around at the back of those dead ends, Jean Valjean had stumbled on the entrance to the gallery in his path, had found it narrower than the main tunnel, and had not gone in. He had disregarded it. The police officers, re-emerging from the Caudron gallery, had thought they heard the noise of footfalls coming from the direction of the ring sewer. They were right. These were Jean Valjean's footsteps. The sergeant in command of the patrol had held up his lantern, and the squad had started peering into the mist over where the noise had come from. This was a moment beyond words for Jean Valjean. Luckily, if he could see the lantern clearly, the lantern could not clearly see him. It was light, and he was shadow. He was a very long way off, and merged into the black darkness of the place. He flattened himself against the wall and stopped. Dead still. In any case, he had no idea what it was that was moving around behind him. Lack of sleep, lack of food, emotional turmoil had thrown him, too, into a hallucinatory state. He saw a flaring light, and around that flaring light, specters. What were they? He didn't have a clue. Jean Valjean having stopped, the noise also stopped. The men on patrol listened and heard nothing. They looked and saw nothing. They conferred. In those days, at that point in the Montmartre sewer, there was a sort of square known as the Service Junction, since done away with because of the small inland lake formed by the torrential runoff that collected there in violent storms. The platoon was able to huddle together in this space. Jean Valjean saw the specters form a sort of circle. They brought their mastiff heads together and whispered. The outcome of this confabulation of guard dogs was that they had been mistaken, that there had been no noise, that no one was there, that there was no point trying to tackle the ring sewer, that it would be a waste of time, but that they needed to get cracking toward Saint-Merry, that if there was anything to be done, and any loudmouth troublemakers or Bousingot to track down, it was in that quarter. From time to time the different parties slapped new souls on their old insults. In 1832 the word Bousingot filled the interim between the word Jacobin, which was old hat, and the word demagogue, or rabble-rouser, which was then almost unused, but which has since done such an excellent job. The sergeant gave the order to veer off to the left toward the downhill slope to the Seine. If it had occurred to them to split into 2 squads and cover both directions at once, Jean Valjean would have been caught. His fate was hanging by a thread. It is likely that instructions from the prefecture, anticipating that there could be a fight, one involving a fair number of insurgents, had ruled out the patrols splintering. The patrol set off again, leaving Jean Valjean behind them. Of all this movement, Jean Valjean saw nothing except the eclipse of the lantern which suddenly swung round the other way. Before going off, the sergeant, to ease the conscience of the police officers, fired his carbine in the direction they were abandoning, at Jean Valjean. The explosion rolled through the basin, echoing along the way as though the Titanic tunnel's gut were rumbling. A chunk of plaster fell into the stream and made the water splash a few feet from where he stood, alerting Jean Valjean to the fact that the musket ball had struck the vault above his head. Slow and measured footsteps reverberated along the channel for a while, but they were more and more dampened the farther away they got. The pack of black shapes slunk into the gloom. A glimmer of light wavered and fluttered, turning the curved arch of the vault a kind of red, before dwindling and disappearing. Silence once more fell. Profound. Blindness and deafness again took hold of the darkness, and Jean Valjean, not yet daring to move again, stayed for a long time with his back to the wall, ears pricked, eyes wide open, watching the vanishing phantom patrol. The man tailed. We must do the police of the day justice and acknowledge that even in the gravest political situations, they carried out their duty imperturbably as far as maintenance of roads and waterways and surveillance went. A riot was not in their eyes a reason for giving malefactors free rein and neglecting society just because the government was in peril. Ordinary duty was performed correctly through extraordinary duty and was in no way disturbed by it. In the middle of a totally unpredictable political event that had taken off, under pressure of a possible revolution, without letting himself be distracted by mere insurrections and barricades, a policeman would tail a thief. It was precisely something of the kind that happened on the afternoon of June 6th down by the Seine, on the embankment of the right bank, a bit beyond the Pont des Invalides. There is no embankment there today. The whole look of the place has changed. On this embankment, two men a certain distance apart looked to be eyeing each other, with one avoiding the other. The one up ahead was trying to get away, the one bringing up the rear was trying to close the gap. It was like a game of chess being played at a distance, silently. Neither man seemed in a hurry. They both walked slowly, as though each of them feared to cause his partner to step up the pace if he showed too much haste. It made you think of a hungry predator following its prey, but trying to look as though it wasn't. The prey was cunning and kept on his guard. The requisite distance between a hounded weasel and the mastiff hounding it was observed. The man trying to escape was a scrawny, skinny-necked weed. The man going after him was a tall, strapping man who looked hard as nails, and would no doubt be hard as nails if you went up against him. The first, feeling himself to be the weaker, avoided the second, but he avoided him in a profoundly furious fashion. Anyone observing him closely would have seen his eyes shining with the glum hostility of a man in flight and with all the menace there is in fear. The embankment was deserted and cut off. There was no one going by, not even a boatman or a longshoreman on the barges moored here and there. You could not easily spot the two men except from the quay opposite, and for anyone studying them at that distance, the man in front would have looked as though his hackles were up, ragged and skulking as he was, fretful and shivering under a tattered smock, and the other man, like some classic official, wearing the overcoat of authority, buttoned up to the chin. The reader would perhaps recognize the two men if they could see them a little closer. What was the second man's objective? Probably to dress the first man in something warmer. When a man dressed by the state pursues a man in rags, it is to turn him, too, into a man dressed by the state. Only the color is the crux of the matter. To be dressed in blue is glorious. To be dressed in red is rather unpleasant. There is such a thing as low-life crimson. It was probably some unpleasantness and a shade of crimson of the kind that the first man hoped to elude. If the second man let him walk ahead and had not yet seized him, it was, to all appearances, in the hopes of seeing him wind up at some important rendezvous with some gang worth nabbing with him that would amount to a good haul all around. This delicate operation is known as tailing. What makes such a conjecture perfectly plausible is that the buttoned-up man, spotting from the embankment an empty fiacre going past, signaled to the driver, and the driver understood, evidently realized with whom he was dealing, turned around and began to follow the two men from the quay at a slow trot. This was not picked up by the shady character in rags, walking ahead. The fiacre rolled along under the trees of the Champs-Élysées. You could see the driver's upper body above the parapet, whip in hand. One of the secret instructions issued by the police to their officers contains this article. Always have a hire car to hand, just in case. While maneuvering each on his side with irreproachable strategy, the two men approached a ramp on the quay that went down to the embankment and which, in those days, allowed coach drivers coming from Passy to go down to the river to water their horses. This ramp has been removed since, in the interests of symmetry. The horses die of thirst, but the eye is flattered. It seemed most likely that the man in the smock would run up this ramp in order to escape down the Champs-Élysées, a place adorned with trees, but also, on the other hand, heavily dotted with police officers, where the other man would have a helping hand. The point of the quay is not very far from the house brought from Moret to Paris in 1824 by Colonel Braque, and known as the house of François Premier. A guardhouse sits right alongside it. To the great surprise of his observer, the hounded man did not take the ramp to the watering place. He kept going along the embankment beside the quay. His position was becoming visibly critical. Apart from throwing himself in the Seine, what was he going to do? No way back up to the quay now, no more ramp, no stairs. And they were very close to the bend in the Seine near the Pont d'Iéna, where the embankment got narrower and narrower, tapering off in a skinny tongue before vanishing underwater. There he would inevitably find himself trapped between the sheer wall on his right, the river on his left and in front of him, and the powers that be at his heels. It is true that the end of the embankment was hidden from sight by a heap of rubble 6 or 7 feet high produced by some demolition or other. But was the man actually hoping to hide effectively behind a heap of rubble anyone could just walk around? The expedient would have been puerile. Surely he wouldn't dream of it. The innocence of crooks has its limits. The heap of debris made a sort of elevation at the water's edge that extended as a promontory right up to the wall of the quay. The man being followed reached this knoll and rounded it so that he couldn't be seen any more by the other man. The latter could not see, but neither could he be seen. He took advantage of that fact to abandon all dissimulation and step up the pace. In a few seconds, he had reached the mound of rubble and turned it. There, he stopped in his tracks, stunned. The man he was hunting was no longer to be seen. The man in the smock had disappeared into thin air. The embankment barely went on for another 30 paces from the heap of rubble before it dived below the water that lapped against the quay wall. The fugitive could not have thrown himself into the Seine or scaled the quay without being seen by the man following him. What had become of him? The man with a buttoned-up coat walked to the very end of the embankment and stayed there a moment, lost in thought, wildly clenching and unclenching his fists, his eyes darting about like a ferret's. All of a sudden he slapped himself on the forehead. At the point where the ground ended and the water began, he had just clapped eyes on an iron gate, wide and low-lying, arched, fitted with a heavy lock and 3 massive hinges. This gate, a sort of door cut into the bottom of the quay, opened onto the river as much as onto the embankment. A blackish stream flowed at the bottom. This stream disgorged into the Seine. On the other side of its heavy rusted iron bars, you could make out a sort of tunnel, vaulted and black. The man folded his arms and gave the gate a look of resentment. Looking was not enough. He then tried to push it open. He rattled it. It resisted without budging. Yet it most likely had just been opened, even if he hadn't heard a sound, which was pretty strange for such a rusty grate. But it had certainly been closed again. This showed that the man this door had just opened for had not a hook, but a key. This obvious fact came to the man in a flash, prompting him to shake the gate as hard as he could, and forcing out of him this roar of indignation. The nerve of it! A government key! Then, instantly calming down, he gave vent to a whole inner world of ideas in a flurry of monosyllables spat out with almost ironic emphasis. Well, 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 well. That said, hoping for who knows what, either to see the man emerge again or to see other men go in, he posted himself on the lookout behind the heap of rubble with the patient rage of a pointer. For its part, the fiacre which mirrored all his movements had come to a halt above him alongside the parapet. The driver, foreseeing a long wait, fitted the muzzles of his horses into the nosebag of Oates, wetted the bottom, which is so familiar to Parisians, being, this said in brackets, something the various governments sometimes apply to them,